John, would you care to elaborate on how to cultivate the heart chakra practice? Is it feeling the heartbeat or more than that? Well, I find that I took care of my mother for a while, and I was very close to her, and I'd often, just being with her, this area, the center of my chest, would feel very open, vibrant, which wasn't really the heartbeat. I don't know what Western science says about that, but it's certainly whether if she was in pain, you know, there'd be a strong feeling there. If she, I created a garden for her on the port, the terrace of the condo, balcony, yeah. And I made a ramp. My record was 63 potted plants. And she hadn't had a garden for years. She loved gardening. And so I had to get her over the wheelchair onto the ramp. You know, it took quite a bit of effort, and she could do it maybe. Well, in the end, like if I got her out there for 30 minutes, it was a big deal. All the conditions had to be right. It had to be summer too. And just see the joy on her face, to see the joy, because she had macular degeneration and her sense of smell wasn't strong and all the rest of it. So just to see the joy of her connecting with nature in that way, because elderly people, they just usually just live in a chair, right? They don't have much scope of movement, and they live with negative sense experience a lot, don't they? Pain and loneliness and all that kind of thing. So seeing her happy brought immense happiness to me, and that registered here. And so what I've done before that too, but I think especially with her, I just started to register my bodily feelings, or notice and acknowledge and recognize the bodily feelings here in my relationship to her. So I learned a lot about literally the center of the chest, and then I would also just repeat those experiences, not to reproduce them, but just to get in touch with that. So in the evening I'd meditate, and I'd go, like if I had a very like I would come back, say I would go to the monastery on the Saturday morning and come back Sunday afternoon. That was my kind of respite. And then I'd always go to the independent store in Carlton Place. Mm-hmm. And then I'd always get her flowers, or someone would get them for me. And then I'd go in, and she'd be in the kitchen and waiting for me. So she's obviously happy to see me. And I'd boing, flowers, and just the joy of it every time. It was just a really easy winner. But then that's that area. That area is very, very important. And then in the evening, I would again sit with that. I would just make that conscious. I'm not good at visualization, but there was enough memory there that was easy to then to hold that, and I would just then practice body awareness in that area. So basically I was stimulating something which is natural, which was part of the empathic part of my being, and I would just keep encouraging that in whatever ways. Now certainly when she had pain, then the other was there too. So she was confused just like when she was dying and all that. That was very, 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 very strong. You can't underemphasize that. But it was significant. It wasn't strong in the sense that I had a backache. It wasn't that kind of a strength. It was an appropriate strength of heart to the situation, and it felt right. It felt open and right. not pleasant, right? But it felt appropriate. So just stimulate, I guess, just stimulating that, and then so. And I think I've always done a bit of that, but I think with Mom it really was a kind of constant gift to be able to do that. And then I use this, like I bring attention to there, see what that's like. And if I really use that a lot to observe when I go into thinking too much, which never happens, of course, because I have a lot of analytical things I need to deal with at the monastery, a lot of planning and architect's drawings and people's stories and da da da. So there's lots of stuff for the thinking mind to go to, and I have to. I can't just dismiss it. But then I try to balance that out by relating here. So quite often at committee meetings, I'll just try to remind myself, go, not that our committee meetings are great, we've got a great committee, no problem, but just to try to relate to the situations that we are describing and to the people from here. And it's quite interesting. I find that if I can relate from here, but having used the brain a bit too, that usually my responses are much more to the person rather than to my own opinions. I still have my own opinions, and, you know, I still have agreements and disagreements, but somehow they go more to a real conversation and dialogue with a person rather than me just kind of, you know, they present a position and then I just present my position, which isn't really dialogue, it's just, what is that? I guess that's warfare. No, it's not warfare, but you know what I mean? So that's been very, very fruitful for me. And so when I practice metta, I practice metta bhavana in the usual way when I started, and that was the sort of, you know, the lists of people that you do, that's very useful. But I found just more being, I guess the physicality of this practice was very helpful for me. But from that, you know, from that idea of connecting to someone in that way, you can then recollect that. So as a practice, I can recollect the perception and feeling of kindness. I can do that. That's not trying to manufacture it. It's just using memory, but not storyline memory, but bodily feeling memory, because our bodies store information, don't they? Like you, if you remember something, you know, someone was really awful to you, and that memory comes, you feel it, don't you? Your body tenses up, and so on. So we have the capacity to recollect the wholesome and the unwholesome. So we can recollect the wholesome by remembering a person. It's quite simple, isn't it? So I find like the easiest access to that sense of heartfelt openness for me is recollecting my teachers, my mom, but Ajahn Sumedho especially now. I just have more and more gratitude for this. I just bring his image up and I feel happy. And then I just hang in here and then may you be well, bring up his image. It's very, very simple, it's not very complicated. And then, so that is that's the recollection of that attitude of mind, attitude of heart. And then I try to apply that to whatever's going on in my life, whatever, whether it's physical pain or cold weather, beautiful weather, or whatever it might be. Try to apply that kind of heart attitude. So it has a kind of intuitive sense to it. It's not so. I've never been good at like step one, step two, step three, step four kind of meditations. I've always been more intuitive, and when I sense something is wholesome, both physically, emotionally, mentally, and so on, I sense something wholesome, then I say, oh, that's skillful. That feels right. Okay, let's go with that. Let's see where that takes me. Which seems to me, we all do to some extent, don't we? I mean, we're intelligent people, and we're kind of looking at ourselves. So the suggestions in the text and so on are broad brush kind of suggestions. So I like to just to notice how thought is really in your brain. You know, when like if you're worried about something, how that really you feel the stress in your head, don't you? In your brain. And actually just to notice that, and rather than to solve the stress with more thought, you kind of explore the body. So actually literally bringing your attention down to here and letting this become conscious. Like not forcing yourself to feel the heart. Okay, sure, I'm worried, but I wonder what the heart chakra feels like. So that idea of waiting, but waiting for nothing. If I'm trying to manufacture a feeling of kindness because I'm worried, then that's just craving and desire. But the exploration and the waiting and then takes a while, and you notice, oh yeah, there's feeling there too. There's sensitivity there too. So I found it really, really fruitful, very, very helpful. So thanks, Mom, for many things. I just had a dream of her the other day. I get some dreams, not often, but boy, they're happy dreams. Like, are you still here? So that anytime you do, you know, you connect with someone in a sincere way, recognize that's the particular that connects you to something more general, you know, whether it's a child or a parent or a partner, whoever it is, you feel that, oh, that connection, yeah, that empathy, and get to know it in the heart. And then it goes beyond the particular to the more general possibility. What practices do you recommend for dealing with desire?
Cold showers.
Eat too much ice cream. Just keep eating ice cream until you can't stand it anymore. What the texts talk about is the advantages and disadvantages. So there's the advantages of desire, and desire itself is not, it's a, in the Pali, we have the word tanha, which is always related, it's always conjoined with ignorance. So the word tanha is a specific Pali word, and it always has inherent in it the idea of ignorance, not understanding clearly. And there are other words around desire, chanda, which is aspiration, which are wholesome desire. So the word in the English word desire is a much broader word and can include the wholesome and the unwholesome, the skillful and the unskillful. Because if we didn't have any desire, we'd never do this. I mean, it's hard work, isn't it? You know, hour after hour meditating when you're not used to it, and it's not a not easy thing to do. So there is wholesome desire and unwholesome desire. Lompa Buddha Thich used to say there's stupid desire and wise desire. So and that I think is important. Otherwise, you kind of get confused. I can't do anything. You know, I just better not do anything. That's desire. So craving then. Craving is always bound up with bhava tanha and vibhava tanha. Those two are always bound up with a sense of self becoming or a sense of self getting rid of. So there's always a sense of me trying to get somewhere or get rid of something. And kama tanha, the hedonistic part or the love of pleasure and the desire to get rid of displeasure is just the absorption all the time into sense pleasure. So sense pleasure in itself is not wrong. I change my posture when it hurts. That's sense pleasure. Again, that's a skillful desire. Otherwise, I'm just going to hurt myself. So the body hurts, and I move out of it. So that's from moving from displeasure to pleasure. That's that's all very well. But the absorption into sense pleasure and the needing of sense pleasure, we can see, say, just the restlessness of kind of internet usage. You know, where our culture now always needs to tweet or email or, you know, what people do. This kind of restlessness always to be with an object. And that's a kind of good reflection on sense. The preoccupation with pleasure is this restlessness in our culture of always needing an object of distraction. Probably the younger generations more so than older generations. But that movement away always to an object, the news or Facebook or all these things. I've never seen a Facebook page, but one certainly hears about it. That movement always out, means that your attention is preoccupied and you can never realize the unconditioned, which is like the home ground. So that's the problem with sense distraction. It's not like a moral, this is evil problem. And that's sometimes we get Buddhist ideas about sensuality mixed up with Abrahamic ideas about sensuality. Not that I understand the Abrahamic religions, but what I've inherited is a kind of sometimes a sense that, you know, you're guilty for feeling things like passion, that it's somehow wrong per se. But it just is as it is. It's nature. It's not right or wrong, it's just nature. So the Buddhist teachings is more like life. You're always preoccupied with objective, or the objects of consciousness. You'll never realize the ultimate subject, say, or the transcendent, because your attention is in the wrong place. So then you can see like it's not just being absorbed into the internet. That in itself, okay, we talk about that, but why not? You know, got to be absorbed into something. Ice cream, internet, doesn't matter. So we kind of tit tit tit. No more internet now. But why? You know, why is that? Why is that problematic? In the Buddhist sense, it's problematic because you're not available for the unconditioned. You're not available for peace. And obviously, on a just a normal psychological level, the mind's always restless, so it's unhappy. So that's very apparent. The mind is very unhappy. But for us, it's a deeper consideration. And then a sense of bhava, again, bhava is always this, you know, how much of our mind is into the future, whether it's worry or fantasy, and then the regurgitation, rehearsing of the past, or the rejection of the present. So all that makes us preoccupied with objects. So how do we let go of the preoccupation? So going back to the question on desire then, again, how do you define desire? This wholesome desire, unwholesome desire, skillful, unskillful, wise, stupid desire. Well, in a classical Buddhist sense, what we as monastics have is we have indriya sanvara, which is sense restraint, and that's one of the foundations of contemplative life in Buddhism is sense restraint, and we all practice sense restraint. Otherwise, we'd just be following our appetites and be really messed up, wouldn't we? So sense restraint is the skillful not going to objects. It's not a rejection of the objective world. So all of us see that, you know, like around food, around television, around like talking a lot, or, you know, different things that we see. I need some kind of boundaries here. I need some kind of restraint. And those are things that everyone who is a contemplative, I think, is always refining. You're always just seeing in your life where going out into the sense world is can be very beautiful in terms of generosity, but it can also just wear you out. You lose your samadhi, you lose your center. So sense restraint is a big one. And how you do that is up to you as a lay person. How we do it is up to us to a certain extent, but it's also governed by quite clear boundaries, which is very, very helpful. Very, very helpful. So we live a celibate life. We live a life where we don't have entertainments. We have limitations around food, and we don't have money, and so, you know, things are really quite bounded. Oh, we can still goof off and sleep all the time and so on, but they're not harmful. And usually, you know, monks do that for a day or two and feel massively guilty and get back on board again. So that's, you eat too much rice. So it's not really harmful. So there's a kind of way where our life is quite skillfully set up where you can indulge, yeah, you can have the midday meal. And go, yeah, have six bowlfuls, go for it. There's no rule against it. But see the consequences. See the consequences. But you can't do it in the evening, I'm sorry. Huh? So you know, there's restraint, but there's, and all those are very, very innocent kind of indulgences that we sometimes get caught up into. But for lay people, it's much different. You know, you have a whole different, you have family pressures of how you should be. So, you know, maybe it's Thanksgiving and it's time everyone's stuffing their face and drinking whatever you drink at Thanksgiving, I don't know. And you have social pressures to function in a certain way, which aren't around sense restraint. Consumerism isn't about sense restraint. Shop until you drop is not about sense restraint. Upgrade is not about sense restraint. You know, getting the latest model is not about sense restraint. Your kids, you want to practice sense restraint, your kids feel, oh, yeah, what am I? Chopped liver, mom, or what, you know? Where's my new shoes, Nike shoes, which cost $150 or whatever. So, I don't know, I mean, these are things I hear about, but it's much more complicated for lay people. How do you practice sense restraint? So to really let go of desire, going back to the classical sort of contemplations, but the Buddha would say there's advantages of following desire, but there's also the disadvantages and the danger and the escape. So you can see how certainly let's say, you know, like on a retreat, maybe you decide, oh, I want a good chat, and you feel restless, so you kind of hook someone else into a long natter, talking about personal history, natter, oh, that was fun. And then you've got it for the next six meditations, natter. Whoa, why did I do that, right? So you see, there's advantages, sure, that was fun, but then there's disadvantages, blah, 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 blah. And you say, and then a second time you want to do that, you say, no. Now I saw the disadvantage. And it's not immoral, it's not that kind of, it's just that my mind will be preoccupied with objects of sense, thoughts. And so I see that, and so now I feel, I see the disadvantage, then I contemplate the escape. So what would be the escape from this desire? It would be patiently watching unfulfilled desire. And that's hard to do. In this case, not so hard. I watch the desire to talk, and I just watch the restlessness, and I walk around a bit, maybe talk to a tree, or do whatever I have to do. It's done. It's done on retreats. And then it it settles down. It settles down, and I don't have the result. I don't have that, you know, that awful result. You think, you know, that's a facetious example, but you think about how, you know, we've blown it on sense experience sometimes. They take the worst would be something like really hurting someone with speech. You know, I've got to tell them. And you just lay into them, and then you get the result. Like maybe it's someone very close to you, and you're just in one of those moods where you feel terribly self-righteous, and you lay into them, and the person, you know, happens to have the flu too, and then you walk away and you've got that karma for weeks and weeks and weeks, and the next argument comes up. Yeah, but then you said that to me, and you said that to me. So the disadvantage, and then so I want to say something really strong to someone. I say, no, I went there last time. That did not work. No, and I walk away and breathe and do some yoga and something. And then, when the heart's cool, then I talk about it in a more cool way. So many ways one could see that. But for us, that those are kind of the social considerations around desire, but for the, like, the transcendent realization, that kind of deep, deep peace that we can realize through not grasping, then we see that all sense experience, all objects are unsatisfactory. They're unsatisfactory because they're unreliable, they're changing. And you have a deeper sense of what renunciation means, and renunciation, the deepest sense is that The only thing worthwhile pursuing is awareness of change, and that's not a pursuit. The only worthwhile thing really to do is just to notice the changing nature of things. And then you play tennis and have your ice cream too. But at a deeper level, realize, yeah, that's the interesting bit. It's awareness of change, or just awareness, which isn't interesting, because everything else is unreliable. So you can still enjoy life and listen to music and so on, but you have this, I think the renunciant heart says, well, yeah, those things are okay, but is there a deeper perspective? Is there something? So it doesn't become a kind of horrible, self-righteous, I'm a renunciant kind of Buddhist trip you lay on other people. It's not that. It's not unhappy in that way. It's more mature. Yeah, I've been there, done that. Been there, done that. And you come home. And it's a curiosity, I think. But it comes from a basic understanding that that which has a nature to arise is a nature to cease, and that is unsatisfactory. And that there is the awareness of that, and that awareness is more interesting. And that's I think, where someone who ordains, that's where we're coming from. It's not just like having failed in life and have to be a monk. That's one of the perspectives they think in Thailand, oh yeah, he's a loser, how to become a monk. Maybe, but there's a deeper aspiration to the realization. So you have to, in terms of desire, you have to see where your mind always wants to pick up objects of sense. Like mostly it's around thinking, because thought is an object of sense, and how that always runs in the direction it runs. How do the preoccupations work, and what would I need to do to balance that out? So if I'm a compulsive worrier, that's not just a kind of therapeutic problem. It's also a spiritual problem. It's a problem psychologically, yeah, but it's a spiritual problem because it denies you access to that peaceful possibility of the heart. So if you're okay, so a lot of thinking that we most, how much of thinking is really useful? 1%? 2%? how much of thinking is just habit going on? So that preoccupation with thought is probably the biggest one, isn't it? Biggest challenge that we have. So desire to get rid of thought won't work either. That won't work. Because that's still desire. So it takes the training in centeredness and stillness, again and again and again, seeing the gaps between thoughts, learning to listen rather than think, all these different ways that we talk about it. So it's a very arduous path. It's not an easy one. But like I said, what else is there to do? Mm-hmm. And I think if you pick it up with interest rather than obligation, now I have to meditate, and then I have to do the garden, and then I have to do the washing, I've got too much to do. That's just another thing on your list. But if you're really curious about the mind, how it works, then meditation is very, it's kind of an interesting exploration. And the first few days of retreat, unfortunately, is just kind of getting in shape. If you haven't been sitting much, then sorry, you're just out of shape. So your mind is restless and your body's sore. I've looked for solutions for that for 30 years, but I just don't know. So I take my glasses off the first few days. Painful to say, I'm falling asleep. So I would like to encourage you in your courage, because it's not easy to kind of stop your life, whatever life you're living, and also just sit, walk, and that's a cold turkey. It's very, very challenging. So do be patient and have faith.